Somebody just joined us?
Alex.
Alex.
Hi, Alex.
Alex
How are
F.
you?
Alex is just back in operation after being down for, what, a year with the fire?
11 months.
11 months.
11 months and one day.
Oh.
Wow.
But who's counting?
Hey, congratulations for getting back open.
Thank you.
Reopened at a 50% volume increase over when he closed.
Wow, that's fabulous.
Less 11 months in one day.
Wow. Where are you located, Alex?
Outside of Philadelphia, Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Great. What kind of operation?
We say we're an American fun food restaurant.
Yeah, great.
Gourmet TGI Fridays for, depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah, all right. What kind of seating capacity you got there?
We, pre-fire, we had approximately 120. Now we've got 165.
Oh, wow. So it's a big place. Pretty big. You do kind of a short turn time and 2.5-3 turns in there?
We, pre-fire, we were running 5.5 turns.
Oh.
Now we're struggling to make 4.
Uh-huh.
It's a new building, new menu.
Larger volume, too.
Larger volume. Well, it's a lot of new things. When we closed the restaurant, we had 12 years of practice. When we reopened the restaurant, we had one day of practice.
Yeah, right.
So,
sure.
It's taken a little extra time to, get everybody up to swing.
Right.
But it's coming real quick. I mean, it's actually we're getting very, very close now to the 4.5, 4.75 turns.
Oh, that's great. That's great. How long has it been actually since you've been open again?
We reopened May 12th.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's great. So you did you have an opportunity to do any training? Because sometimes, you get your, certificate of occupancy and like you want to open that day, and there isn't a nice long training period in between the time you get the building turned over to you and when you got to open.
Well, we were very fortunate. We got, first off, we paid our kitchen staff for the entire year that we were closed.
Oh, wow, that's great.
So out of, we kept 18 cooks on the payroll, line cooks and prep cooks, and most of our staff we found jobs for, and actually we got approximately 85% of our floor staff back.
Wow, that's great.
So it wasn't a matter of a whole, wasn't a whole new staff to retrain. It was just a matter of our old staff that we brought back about 10 days before opening to help us put the place together.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, in turn, we doubled them up, double-teamed them with an old employee with a new employee.
Yeah.
And we checkerboarded tables the first week so that we had an old person with a new person every day the first week.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, it's incredibly admirable. I mean, I think it's the right thing to do, but most people can't, take care of your people in the off time. And
you can if you know how to work the insurance company.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing, and it's really, I believe, the right thing to do, and it's good business. Some guys, just do it differently, and. As I said, I think that's incredibly admirable, and that's awesome.
What's the insurance angle to that, Alex?
Well, the insurance angle to that is that your typical insurance policy says they will pay for your key people. And when you sit down with the insurance company, they ask you for a list of the key people that you want, and they kind of guide you by starting the conversation off by saying, now, of course, the key people are you, your partner, your head chef, and your bookkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
So you are more or less led to believe right off that that's the only people that the insurance company is going to
right.
consider key people.
Yeah.
So you then, in turn, say, "Wait a minute! Now I can't reopen my restaurant without you know, this person, and this person." And they say, "Well, we don't consider them key people. We're not gonna pay for them." So you have to go out on a limb, and you have to say, "Well, I don't care what you're going to do. I have to protect my business, and the only way I can protect my business is to keep these people on the payroll." So now what you do is you establish a precedent that you did have to have these people.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Because if you don't pay them, you know, if you listen to the insurance company, they're going to, you know, you're not going to pay them. They're going to be gone. And then it's pretty tough to go back to the insurance company and say, "Well, I would have paid them."
Right, right.
Well, you didn't pay them, did you? So you've got no argument.
You went ahead and paid them out of your own.
I did have to pay them out of my own pocket for roughly the first 4.5 months.
Wow, so then you're hoping that the insurance company will relent and allow you, you know, say yeah and then reimburse you.
Well, I knew that if I didn't take the position that I had to pay them.
Yeah.
And if I didn't pay them, I knew that I had no argument.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a chance that you have to take.
Right, sure.
But if you don't take it, you've got no chance.
Well, you're definitely going to lose them. And,
right.
And then all you can do is hope they'll come back when it's time. As I'm saying, I think that's good business. It's good business because you're protecting your integrity and your product and your known service. I mean, it's pretty rare, though, these days in our business to find individuals like yourself that just go to that length. I was watching on an educational channel the other night. There's a textile mill in Massachusetts that burned down.
I know exactly who you're talking about. That's the guy that invented the fleece cloth.
Yep. And he kept all of his people paid for, you know, it was up in the millions of dollars and so forth. But my wife and I were just sitting there looking at him and thinking, you know, how it was when we had our own restaurant. And, man, it brought a tear to my eye, I have to say. You know, I mean, it's an incredible yet rare thing which speaks poorly of our business community these days.
Well, the unusual thing about that situation was that guy was in serious financial trouble before the fire.
Yeah, see, they didn't say that.
The real thing is that guy was, and he was an old guy who really didn't have anything else in the world to do.
Yeah.
He did have a bunch of money.
Yeah.
And he said, "The heck with it, you know, regardless of whether I make it or don't make it, these people got me where I am."
Right, right.
"And I'm going to spend the money and put it back in a community."
Right, and the town was dependent on that one last plant that was there. There was
yep.
a lot of people, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but, I mean, the principle is really kind of the same. In
oh, absolutely.
You believe in what you're doing. You are willing to risk and go out on the limb for your dream, you know, and because that's your reality. It's your lifeblood, I think that's great.
I'm just wondering if there isn't some sort of an insurance product that you could take out that would cover you for that 4 month or 6 month period up front.
I think most insurance policies will, because you know they have loss of business and all of these things built
in. Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Your loss of business coverage.
Yeah.
But the insurance company. First off, you sit down with your insurance company, you sit down with your insurance broker, you know, like the day after the fire.
Yeah.
And they kind of, the representative from the insurance company,
mm-hmm.
he automatically is there to save the insurance company money, not pay you money.
Of course.
So initially, he is going to guide you in a direction that is going to be favorable for the insurance company. And the first thing that they start with is, well, here's what we're going to pay and here's what we're not going to pay. And like I said, if you listen to these guys and you are not willing to take some risk on your own, then
that's all you're going to get.
That's the game plan for
yep.
them.
Yep. Yep. Hmm. We had a small fire in my wife and our restaurant about 10 years ago. And actually, we were only closed down for 12 days because it was very small and we worked, you know, 24 hours a day to put everything back in there. It was mostly smoke damage. And the insurance company did cover the loss of business for those days, and we were able to pay all the people. But again, that was only 12 days, you know, not a year, you know. So I think most policies have that, but as you're saying, you have to read between the lines and not just listen to what they tell you to get the maximum you can.
Absolutely.
But I think if you were to try to specify something like that in a policy, it would just cost you an arm and a leg, which, I mean, it already does.
Already does.
Yep. Anytime you want to add something in, cover anything specifically, it's going to be in the thousands, no matter which way you look at it, whether you're trying to cover additional artwork or special equipment or whatever it may be. You know, you try to write in those things on the policies, it's just not even worth it.
But they finally came in. They finally came around, and did they reimburse you for the first 4 months?
Well, you automatically. Well, I'm going to say automatic. Every policy is different, and every state. You know, every insurance company goes to the individual state and hands them the policy that they want to write, and the state approves it or disapproves it, and you eventually end up with a policy that's going to be written in your state. But then. So the policy that is written in Pennsylvania may not be the policy that's written in Ohio, which is the adjoining state. But every policy under your business interruption is going to pay you so much money for the first so many days. You're 100% of your employees.
Right.
So in your case, they paid you for the whole time because you were closed, let's say, less than 30 days. They paid everybody.
Yeah, and I think, if I recall, our policy, I believe it's 30 or 90 days, and I just can't remember, that they will cover.
Yeah, normally it's 60 days.
Oh, okay.
And then after 60 days, that's when you have to make the decision, do I consider these people key to my being able to survive when I reopen?
So you were able to maintain all of your 18 cooks? That's including prep people and everybody, or just primary, like, sous chefs, line cooks?
Well, I kept, of course, my head chef, but that wasn't included in the 18.
Yeah.
I kept all of my line cooks except two.
Uh-huh.
I kept my prep, day prep and weekend prep manager. I kept two of my day prep people. I kept one of my weekend prep people. I kept one of my night prep people.
Mm-hmm.
And God, I might lose track there. I don't know whether I'm at work.
No, that's great.
But
that's great. So you know, how was it walking in to your new building? I mean, of course, you're used to the old property. But, you know, when you get to rebuild, you know, you do get to order shiny new equipment and maybe something a little more appropriate to what you had, unless, you know, your other building was relatively new.
Our building was very, very, very old.
Oh, see, okay. So, but let me ask, that's my question. Did you prefer, you know, the old building to the new, or are you really happy with the new, with the shiny new equipment that is more appropriate to the jobs and so forth? It's kind of like Christmas Day when you're unpacking all the boxes.
Well, without this turning into my interview instead of your interview, we basically lost from the roof up.
Uh-huh.
As far as physical structure.
Uh-huh.
Everything else was water and smoke.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
So the perimeter of the building was still there. At that point, we made some decisions as to, you know, what direction we were going to go, what direction we had to go, and we basically gutted the entire building and started over interior-wise from scratch.
Yeah, sure.
And made a lot of changes,
mm-hmm.
And we also increased the size of the restaurant.
Right.
We had to do that because of the code upgrade.
Sure.
Portions. We get killed on code upgrades.
Bathrooms and all that, especially.
I'm sorry, what?
Especially in the bathrooms and common areas?
The bathrooms were the easy part. The insurance company, as an example, gave us an allowance of $16,000 to rewire the building as a result of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
But the state codes, to meet the new state codes, it cost us $65,000.
Yeah.
So those are the things that we got hammered on, and they're the things that the insurance companies don't pay you for.
Right, I see.
So faced with those kinds of potential, ridiculously, high cost over and above where we were, we knew that we could not reopen the restaurant and survive with the remaining square footage.
And with the amount of seats that you had before.
Well, we would have lost seats.
Oh.
As a result of the changes that we had to make.
Yeah, yeah.
Because without this turning into my interview.
Yeah, no, but this is fascinating. So I'm really enjoying talking to you about it. So overall, let me ask you this question. Are you happy and satisfied with the floor plan, the footprint, the operational aspect of its functionality? Like, you designed it to be a certain way. I'm thinking, of course, you were thinking of any challenges you had before, and you refine those things into the new plan. But always, when you put it on paper, and then when the engineers design it, and then you build it, there are a couple of little wrinkles. But is it smoother and better according to your plan?
We're already remodeling.
See?
Okay.
Been there.
How's that?
Yeah, okay, I got it. Right.
As a matter of fact, a week after we opened, we put in twice the refrigeration that we had in the restaurant before.
Yeah.
And a week after we opened, we were out of refrigeration space. So we took the chef's office and gutted it and turned it into refrigeration and put it out in the middle of the floor with a card table.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I can relate. I understand that. We just recently built this brand new hotel, and that's where my restaurant is located. And of course, it's state of the art. Everything was brand new, and it was like Christmas Day. When we're doing the load in and all the equipment is arriving, and we're installing everything and putting it all in, it was great. I have to say, a lot of it was really well designed. Well, most all of it was really well designed. There were a couple little wrinkles, and we caught most of those prior to the actual building, because we were working with chefs and people that, this is going to be your kitchen, line this up, set it up, look at the plan we've got, what would you do to change it, and just minor alterations of equipment mostly. But storage is always a key problem. I don't care where you are. There's never enough storage. And these days, with the cost of building and the per square foot and all that, it seems like the first thing that, you want to cut down, or that you need to cut down, is you can't cut your kitchen size. You can't cut the amount of square footage for seating, because that's where you get your revenue. The first thing that goes is storage, and then you got to get really creative.
Well, we wanted to increase our refrigeration because we wanted to increase our catering business.
Oh, yeah.
And there was no way that we were going to be able to increase our catering business without increased refrigeration.
Sure.
You're bringing all this extra food in.
Right.
Prior to get everything, to put everything together before it's going to leave.
Right, right. Plus, you got to store it once it's made on the rack and rolls or whatever inside the fridge.
Sure.
Yeah.
So your excess off-site catered is limited to the amount of refrigeration. So we thought we were really, really rocking and rolling with all this extra refrigeration we put in.
Mm-hmm.
But then we increased our business, by 50%.
Right.
So we now have 50% more food in prep state.
Yeah, right.
So now all that excess refrigeration that we thought we were going to have, for catering now we don't have it.
Yeah, right.
So,
so would you? What kind of wine program do you have over there? Is it extensive or very limited? Few by the glass or California only? Or I mean, what's just basically your style there?
I was just looking at my first P&L, and I did $88,000 in draft beer.
Wow.
I did $21,000 in hard liquor, and I did $4,000 in change in wine.
Uh-huh.
We are a 200-plus beer bar.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. That's the feature.
That's our niche. Our niche is the Belgian beers that nobody has. The high quality beers. We don't have as an example. We don't have Coors. We don't have Miller. We don't have Bud.
Oh wow.
So,
what domestics do you do? You know, is your big feature domestic?
As far as wine is concerned.
No. Your beer. Because you don't have Coors, Miller, or Bud. So is it all, I mean, what are you just going with small microbreweries or like Sam Adams or something like that from the United States?
We buy from microbreweries that have won a gold, silver, or bronze medal.
Oh, yeah, okay, great.
If they have not won a gold, silver, or bronze, we typically do not buy from that brewery.
Right, sure.
The thing that I kind of mentioned here, just for by way of background, Michael, was that because of some admin screw ups on our end, Alex never got the tape of your interview.
Oh, okay.
So he's kind of working blind.
Okay.
I think one of the reasons for some of Michael's questions, Alex, is they have an absolutely massive wine program at Napa Rose.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I would say it's kind of just the opposite in that I sell so little beer. I got a few good beers on tap, but we sell probably 120,000 a month in wine, and really an excessive amount as far as other restaurants would be concerned. We do about 28% to 29% a day of sales is wine. So it's really a wine-generated restaurant. It's a wine country theme. It's called Napa Rose, named after the roses that grow at the end of the vineyard rows up in the vineyards, both in Europe and the United States. And it's got that kind of romantic wine country theme to it. And we pour about 60 wines by the glass, including some really super high-end, rare, hard-to-get, expensive, like Camus Cabernet and Silver Oak Cabernet and William Selyem Pinot Noirs and really rare things by the glass at $30-$35, but you'd be amazed they sell like crazy because people, mostly they can't ever get those wines. They've read about them and heard about them and they never see them, but also it helps them to buy in and drink that and taste that rather than having to spend $140 or $50 on a bottle of wine.
Well, that's exactly what I'm doing with beer.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. So you're allowing them the opportunity of something rare and special that they can't get anywhere else. They got to come to you, and especially with the beers, they're good markup items. It's a good business.
Well, I have as an example, I have over 60 Belgian imports.
Wow, man, that's great.
So if you want to drink a Belgian style beer, you are going to have to come to my restaurant.
Right. Yeah, that's great.
And if you drink enough beer, sooner or later you're going to get hungry and you're going to want to eat some food.
Sure.
So I'm doing the same concept, same thing you're doing, but my niche is the beer and your niche is the wine.
Exactly. Well, and it works. They
work. Sure.
Because anytime you can find something that's desirable. It's one thing to pick something that's rare, but it might be obscure, and it's not as desirable to mainstream. But when you find something that is desirable to the mainstream, that's also rare, and you build your niche, I got to tell you, I think that Well, it's all a matter of timing, too, and then if everybody else jumps on the bandwagon, eventually maybe you need to find some other niche, but I think with yours and with mine, I think we're right on time. And with baby boomers getting older, I think they're enjoying these finer things, and it just seems to be working. I know it sounds like it's working really well for you, and I know on my end it is, too.
You have to have something different and unique than everybody else has.
Right, right.
As I'm fond of saying, the world doesn't need one more place to eat.
Yeah. Like you say, Bill, you know, you say it so often. We don't need just another mediocre restaurant to go to. Because if we do, we're going to go to it. We're going to eat there once. You're just not going to go back.
What percentage of your, Alex, what percentage of your sales is food? I could probably sit down and figure it out, but...
We used to be 75-25. When I did do the rebuild, I doubled the size of my bar. So now we're just on the edge of 60-40.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think you want to get too much heavier on alcohol than that.
Well, my insurance rates are going to skyrocket.
I was 50-50 with the San Francisco restaurant. I was 50-50 at one point. It was just nasty.
Yeah.
Well, I never had bouncers before. And now I don't have bouncers. I have public relations people.
Oh, there you go.
Big public relations people.
Yeah,
big time public relations people.
They're very public.
What do you do?
We have our bouncers have staff shirts that say Public Relations Department.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's beautiful. So you know, what kind of training do you folks do with the beer? Do you actually encourage the tasting? Do you do training sessions? I mean, you must if you have that many to get them at least to be able to pronounce them properly and understand what the differences are, right?
Well, we try, and I use the word try.
Yeah.
We try to have bartenders that have worked other places where they have had an introduction to beer in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, they're not going to have the the same kind of the same scale that we have,
right?
But something close to it. Mm-hmm. We're looking for our people have to know. They have to know. We have a book, basically. It's a beer guide that's on the bar for our patrons.
Oh yeah.
So our patrons can look and they can read it, and all of the beers are listed in the book. And they can use that book. They put their name on it. And it stays behind the bar. When they come in, they can check off what they drank and make their own comments as to what they thought about a given beer, what they didn't like.
Yeah, sure.
And then there's a whole description of how beer is made, you know, all the way from the beginning of ancient times, et cetera, et cetera. And our bartenders are expected to know everything that's in that book word for word.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, when I say word for word,
right?
You know, they pretty much have to be able to recite everything that's in that book.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in exact order, but
right. No, but they're familiar. They're intimately familiar with the product.
Intimately familiar with the product, and they have to be able to taste the difference between, you know, certain beers as opposed to other beers.
Right. So if you're looking for the flavor profile, they can describe that too.
Right.
That's what we do with wine too. Virtually, we...
I'm trying to do everything you're doing, except I'm doing it with beer.
I think it's great. It's great. Well, what we have done is actually take it a step further and do a true sommelier training program and teach about it. Well, it's a 6 to 9 month long course. An hour and a half a week until the last 2 months, and then it's twice a week, 3 hours a week, and an intensive training of not just wines, but all spirits, and including beer. We really just graze over beer in comparison to what you're doing, but a true sommelier in the old sense of the word, is responsible for the service and knowledge of all of those things, including cigars, any beverage, including wine, liquor, beer, waters, all that stuff.
Right.
So there's intensive training of all the wine regions of the world, the different grapes, the techniques and methods that are used, the service of those things, the proper temperatures, and of course the names, you know, of different vineyards and you know, the AOC status, Grand Cru, Premier Cru, all that stuff, and then the technique and method of producing liquors, different kinds of stills, all that stuff, as well as cigars. And then we have the International Court of Master Sommeliers actually come to the property and administer this exam. It's a 3-day process. And so right now we've got 26 of what we call them cast members, our staff at Disney, in the Napa Rose restaurant, or have the certification, a level one certification from the Court of Masters. And that just, it, you know, I mean, it's great for bragging rights and certainly for advertising, but more than anything, it really, you got to see the twinkle in the eyes of these young people as they're learning, and they have that kind of pride and a little bit of swagger because they're confident and they're comfortable with the knowledge, and they're not going to be afraid at a table if someone asks them a question that they can't answer. You know, they're going to say, well, let me find out the answer, and then they go and look where they need to get it. They don't make stuff up.
Sounds like your people are going through a lot more than my people are, but that's, you know.
Well, I mean, the wine side of things.
Yeah, sure. Well, with the service at the tables of wine, it's a lot, and we're trying to go with a more kind of classical model, but certainly the philosophy and the concept is the same. And it's been real helpful for us because now, I mean, it's amazing all the wines on our list sell. There are no dogs. Anything from the $18 bottle to the $2,500 bottle, and everything sells. Nothing just sits there. I'm amazed, actually, myself, and, you know, going in there every day at how the thing is working. So I think the amount of training you do, you can't afford not to, and that's my big thing right now is trying to get this word out there to people that like myself in the old days believed, you know, we had a little mom and pop restaurant, and my family's owned restaurants for years and years, and they never did, you know, training per se. You had people that were there forever and they knew what they're supposed to do, and you just do it. And, you know, rarely if ever coming in with new information or sharing knowledge or best practices or new product information. It wasn't happening. And nowadays, I think, you can't afford not to do that. You have to do it in order to stay competitive and with an edge and excel in service.
Absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of folks will tell me, you know, when I, you know, propose these things, or when, you know, in some speaking engagement or a meeting or something, and they're asking me about our training program because it's becoming well known, they're saying, yeah, well, you guys at Disney, you got a lot of money, you can afford to do all that training. And while that is true, we still have to be profitable, and we answer to shareholders. So at some point, the operation needs to be making money. And it's not like, I mean, yes, it's a big company and the operations are very large, so, you know, relatively speaking, there's more money you're working with, but by the same token, the percentages have to be there. And that's where I make my argument, is that myself included, sometimes we get a little stuck, and it's good to go peek out there to see what, you know, others are doing and what the state of the industry is doing, so that we can stay fresh and crisp, because we're the leaders. And if we don't stay fresh and crisp and we get stuck and tired, our staff and the people that work with us every day, they're going to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. The staff's no better than the leader.
Yeah, we have to remain passionate and excited and like what we do, and then do it to the best we can and be the role models for our people. Then they want to work with you, and they are excited, and like they're excited when you find a new beer and you bring it in and you tell them, you know, wow, look at this one I got, and there's only so many made It's very rare. It's from this particular place in Belgium or wherever it may be. And the flavor profile is incredible because da-da-da, and then you taste them on it, and they get excited, and they can't wait to go sell it at their next table.
Absolutely right.
Now, one of the things that, that Michael's done extremely well, and I thought that the thing, one of the stats that you threw out, Michael, I thought was interesting, is you've got, what, four of your kitchen crew that are also first-level sommelier?
Right, that's true. We, the executive chef and all four of his sous chefs have gone through the wine program, and now actually two of the line cooks, and I got two more going through this current class that we have right now. So we're also building chefs as sommeliers too, not so much from a service standpoint, but from understanding the flavors and being able to do, you know, menu writing and menu creation and recipe development. We're a wine restaurant, so it's all about the pairing of food and wine. And although I gotta say, we're located, you know, in a hotel right next door to Disneyland, so we cater to families as well. It's not just only about wine, but that's the focus of the restaurant. And we do this 4-course prefix menu every week. It changes with 4 wines, and so we're really trying to provide courses or a dish that really pairs perfectly with a particular kind of wine and turn somebody on to that so that they will be able to discover, or if they already know these things, enjoy really perfect pairings. And many people say a lot, wow, now I never knew what you were talking about. Yeah, red wine with meat and white wine with fish, but I really didn't understand a perfect food pairing because this just goes together like it's unbelievable. And I know the same thing is definitely possible with beers because, well, just from experience, we know that. And when you provide that experience for your guests, it's something they don't forget. They want to bring their friends back and turn them onto it so they can be a hero too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering, Alex, if you'd made any efforts to try to coordinate the food menu with the beers. And
well, we do. I say we do. We did. And we intend to do so again, you know, this year. We do beer dinners.
Yeah.
And what we do is we get typically two of our vendors to bring in usually a keg each, which we put on tap, and we pass out their beer free. That particular style, I mean, let's just say one's an oatmeal stout and one's a lager. And then they'll bring in bottles of the other 6 or 8 products that they make. And the people come in and they drink the tap beer all they want and they taste all. And then we cook, we prepare the meal. We don't match a beer with a course. Actually make a course using beer.
Right. Yeah, that's great.
So as an example, you know, we might use a chocolate stout to make a chocolate cake.
Sure.
And then it goes on, and we give them, we don't do sit-down dinners because it's beer.
Right, sure, sure. No, but you got food that they can graze on, you know, while they're drinking the beer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, and then we give them copies of the menu, and we give them recipes, so that they can go home and duplicate them. And of course, when they can't find these beers at the local beer store,
right,
you know, we just happen to have them in stock and they can buy them from us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course, because you're the only place around that has it.
Yeah, just, you know, we just kind of skew it a little toward us.
That's good, you know. That's great marketing. It's brilliant.
Mama didn't raise no dumb kids.
You know, to be applauded, because that's the nature of developing a successful business, to me.
That's what we're trying to do.
I mean, that's just because it's natural. It's.
Now this year we're going to do something just a little bit different. I have a good friend who's in part owner in 4 hotels, and they do a 2 events a year that are big charity fundraisers for charity. So we're going to tie our one of our beer dinners into a charity function this year.
Oh, yeah. You get good exposure there.
So we're looking to get a lot more exposure, number one. We're also looking to get more publicity out of it than
right.
we typically do. You know, and you know, that's the way we're going. And we've got some the charities that we're picking. We're going to have some of the local stars, you know, that will be you know, come and be part of the deal.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's good. It's good for the goodwill, you know, for your community and everything too. Those types of events are very good for PR, and you're getting your food and your beverages into the mouths of those people. So, you know, that's better than advertising in any, you know, print.
The more you give back to the community, the more publicity you're going to get.
That too. Yep. Yeah, it sounds great. We I want to get back to the training for just a moment, because the one thing in the training that I think is really key, and that you said that you do, is that, you know, to me, we really need to allow our people to taste. They have to be able to taste so that they can decide what goes together, what doesn't go together, what tastes delicious, what doesn't, as far as the pairings or the way you're going to serve it or the right temperature and all of those things. Because you can tell people that forever, but until they actually taste it and get that sensation of the flavor, then their eyes light up. Now you've got them. It's like a picture's worth a thousand words. So is a taste. Now, we don't encourage, you know, drinking, certainly, but we sip and spit, because as tasters, professional tasters will do, you don't drink. You're tasting, you slurp it, and then you spit it out. But we will prepare dishes alongside with the wines or whatever we're tasting to make sure that things are going together. And as Bill was saying with the chefs, that's what's been real helpful, because I think we tend to print material and hand it out. We do these long training sessions and lineups and pre-shift meals and all that, and tell you all the ingredients that are in the dish. But if we actually give you a taste of it and you say, wow, that's delicious, not only will you sell it probably at the next table, but you'll remember what went in it.
Here's one you might want to write down.
Yeah.
Lindemann's Framois.
Yeah, the raspberry beer.
You got it. We probably sell more of that than anybody in the state.
Wow.
Because every time a woman says, I don't drink beer.
Yeah, perfect.
We say, well, we don't want to serve you beer. But we would like you to taste a brand new product that we just brought in.
Yeah, delicious raspberry flavor.
Delicious raspberry.
Yeah.
And then they taste it. Oh, that's really good.
That's great.
Well, you just drank beer.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't drink beer.
Yeah.
That wasn't beer. I know it wasn't.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, do you have any questions about the Napa Rose or the operation or anything?
Not really. I'm just kind of you know, glad to hear that there's, you know, that there's somebody out there besides myself that's really looking at that niche market, and because that to me is where the future of the independent, you know, non-chain operator, he's got to be able to do something different than the chains do.
Right, that's true.
Otherwise, we might as well just go buy a franchise.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and your creativity, you know, it's got to come from your passion at some point for what you do, what you like, you know. And well, it's one area where we have to, once we've got all this passion and we're excited about what we like, then I have to step back for a moment and kind of, you know, feel out the playing field and see what my guests are liking too, like you're doing. where you bring in this product that you got people that say, I don't want to drink beer, especially like the ladies or whatnot, and then you have something for them. And it might not be something that you drink, but you realize that you need it for your market. And the same thing goes with wine, especially in the wine business in these days, in the more eclectic kind of higher-end type of restaurants with really fancy wine lists, for lack of a better word, they take themselves really seriously. And sometimes they take themselves too seriously. They forget that the guest is the guest. You know, we're here to serve the guest, provide them what they want. Sometimes, you know, out here, especially in California, you go to a restaurant. I know it happens in New York, too. And you in a nice fine dining place, and you sit down. Somebody may want to order a white Zinfandel because they like a sweet, refreshing wine, and they're almost laughed out of the place. Oh, we don't have that here. I think that's terrible.
We don't serve that here. We're better than that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I got one of the finest wine lists in the country, and I sell white Zinfandel all day because if the guest wants it, I'm providing something that they desire. I'm still making a sale. I'm making the guest happy. Who am I to tell them, no, you can't have that. It's not good enough for you. Because it's not good enough for me. I think that's so wrong.
Well, we kind of do that with Coors Light.
Yeah. Well, no, I can understand. Because you don't have that or Bud, right? But you have a great, you know, option. And I bet if, like, 300 people a week came in demanding Coors Light, you might consider it. Or not.
I keep telling my partner, we got to put at least one six-pack in there someplace.
Yeah. For the guy
he keeps saying, they could go across the street.
Yeah. Well, I understand that, too. You know, you got 60 Belgian beers. Come on, try one.
Well, I can give them a beer that tastes just as good, you know.
Yeah.
With just as low of calories, with just as low as whatever, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It gives me the opportunity to. There must be in the car. It must give me the opportunity. It gives me the opportunity to introduce them to something else.
Right. Well, and I guess the you know, you're still giving them the lager that they're looking for. You know, well, maybe Beechwood aged. I don't know, whatever the profile they're looking for. And that speaks to the wines too. Maybe I don't have the brand they're looking for. Like you don't have the brand, but you got the beer. Like I got the wine. You want white Zin? I got white Zin. It may not be the one you're looking for, but I've got one and it's good.
Sure, that's it.
And there's a story, and we'll tell it to you.
And you get a chance to tell your story.
Exactly.
And
that's the whole point, you know. That's why you've got those beautiful books that you give them. And they get to taste and write notes, and you're educating them without teaching them how to eat and drink.
You can't do that.
No. We tried that in the 80s. It doesn't work.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's great. My wine list, I got over 1,000 wines in the cellar, but
to have a copy of your wine list.
Sure. But we only put about 300 wines on the list at any one given time.
I'll trade you my beer list for your wine list.
Yeah, that sounds great. Sounds great. Have you got it on an electric file? Can you email it?
You can go, actually.
You got a website?
Yeah, we have a website, and we rotate. We have 20 drafts all the time, and they rotate 3-4 a week.
Mm-hmm.
So typically twice a week we will change our beers on our website so that our customers can look up and say, oh, they've got this on draft this week. I got that on draft right now.
I
can run
cool.
over and get that one.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's isacnewtons.com.
I-S-S-A-C?
I-S-A-A-C.
Okay.
Newtons, newtons.com.
Great.
And click on the beer. Carl, are all the beers up yet?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Actually, we don't currently have our menu or our wine list on the net, but I can email you a copy. And
okay,
but as
email.
I'm saying, it really only reflects a third of the wines we own because I reprint every 2 or 3 days and add and delete. What's your email?
A.
Uh-huh.
Dot.
Yep.
HAFF @verizon.net.
So that's A dot at H A
A dot
yeah.
H A F F.
Oh, okay. Yeah, at Verizon.net.
At Verizon.net.
Okay. Yeah, when I get into work tomorrow, I'll send it off to you.
Fantastic.
Yeah, we're catching him on his day off. So
yeah, but
I'm going to start taking those now that I'm open again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to take one now and then. That's the one thing Disney's been able to help me and teach me a little bit is to try to get some balance. Because in our industry, it was all about 6 or 7 days a week, 12, 14 hours a day, and no life outside of that. And so we make the business be our life. But that's why I really love working for Disney now, because I'm still doing the fine dining thing that I like to do. I'm doing a lot of education and wine education that I love to do. But I also get 2 days off a week, which is unheard of back in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really great.
Terrific. Well, listen, Michael, I appreciate you taking the time.
Sure, so, Bill.
We're going to be doing, just by the way, Alex, we're going to be doing a day at Napa Rose at the Super Summit.
What is the Super Summit, Bill?
Summit is probably, I mean, the closest thing to what you've seen is Rory's Boot Camp, but not quite there's a couple people that'll have some product, but it's mostly just some people that really impress me with the way they think, doing things that our typical sponsor wouldn't let us do.
Mm-hmm.
All the things we've always wanted to say to an audience, but never had a sponsor who'd let us do it. So it's really kind of politically incorrect. It's on the edge.
It's honest.
Yeah.
I like to spend a minute or two with you on a private phone call relative to that.
Okay.
And actually, I have to sign off now.
Okay.
So, gentlemen, thank you very much. And, Alex, great meeting you.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah, I hope I can actually meet you in person one day. And, Bill, thanks so much.
Great. Give me a call when you get back in.
Yeah,
because we need to sort out a few things about September.
Right. Okay. Very good. We'll take care, guys.
All right.
Okay. Bye now.
Okay. Thanks so much.